And welcome to Minute 13 of the Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick, Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again today on this lovely Wednesday in the middle of July, which, if I know correctly, I'm actually on my way to Maine today. I'm driving from New York to Maine. Hopefully, unless my plans have changed by that point, but that is the plan. So joining me today is Alan Sanders of The Wilder Ride. Welcome back, Alan.
Hey, buddy. Thanks so much for having me back. Really appreciate the offer to come with you on this journey.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm doing my own journey today, which should take me about 7 hours. So hopefully, you know, we won't talk for that long. Hopefully we won't keep people here for 7 hours. We'll have to figure that one out. So minute 13 begins with John looking up at Takagi as he ascends a flight of stairs and ends with John getting cut off mid-compliment. So yesterday's minute ended with McLean looking around trying to figure out what he, you know, how is he supposed to find his wife in this crowd of executives? And he somehow finds his way. And he sees someone who looks like he might have the answer. So he starts walking up the stairs to him. And he starts talking to this man who he doesn't know who he is and says, "Hi, I'm looking for..." And then he gets cut off. "Holly Gennaro." And he goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Ah, you must be John McClane. Joe Takagi. Hi." And then Takagi goes, "How's your ride in?" And he goes, "Nice. I have you to thank for that." And he goes, "Well, it seems the least we could do." He goes, "Well, it's quite a nice place you have here." And says, "It will be if we ever get it finished. There are still several floors under construction." So first of all, this is such a great conversation. You know, you have these two people who sort of know who each other are, but they don't really know who each other are. And right. they quickly start this nice conversation between the two of them, which on the one hand you can say, okay, it's somewhat superficial, but again, the two of them have heard of the other person. I'm sure that John has heard stories of Takagi, and I'm assuming that Takagi has heard stories of John, which we'll get to even later in this minute, where we will talk about how we know that Takagi has heard things about John. But
I do think, as far as a superficial conversation, which it's very polite, it's very surface level, you do get the sense that they're almost sort of feeling each other out. Where are the authoritarian boundaries, and how far can you maybe push something that could be considered maybe less polite? Like, "I've got you to thank for that. Least we could do." You know, it's a little bit of that back and forth, not necessarily rude, but you get the sense of two people who are used to being able to interrogate, one maybe for business, one suspects.
Well, they're both used for business. It's a different type of business.
Yeah, different kind of business, but they're both used to playing that game of learning as much as they can as quickly as possible.
Yes, for sure. And I mean, first of all, one of the things that jumped out at me about this, and it always has whenever I've seen it, you know, Takagi automatically knows that this is John McClane. So you would think, okay, he's the executive of a company with, let's say, hundreds of employees. We don't know how many employees there really are. This might just be a party for the senior executives. I don't know. But he knows by looking out at the crowd that, okay, this is someone who's standing out and is different, and therefore this must be John McClane. You know, it's not one of my employees. I mean, I remember years ago I was in a school, and the principal of the school would come into the room, and I think there were 80 of us in the class, something like that, and he would look around and say, "Okay, where's this guy? Where's that guy? Where's this one? You know, why isn't he here?" And it always amazed me. I was like, how could he have such great memory to look at? I mean, you can look at a group of people and know who is there, but to actually point out who's not there is much more difficult, unless you're specifically looking for people and then you're making a list. Okay, well, Alan's not there and Rob's not there. So, you know, it must be that. You know, I never understood the tactic used in that memory game. But it always amazes me. And I see that Takagi is more or less doing the same thing here. He's looking out. He knows who all these people are. And, okay, here's someone who's standing out. This must be John McClane.
I also think, and you're right, I think somebody who rises to that level of executive, if they don't inhabit that skill themselves, they've got somebody usually right beside them on their right shoulder who does have that skill whispering, yes. Okay, this is so-and-so walking up. Remember, you met them last year at this party. Their wife is this name. They have two kids. They're one of them's going to college. You know, you've got that person that's whispering. If you don't have that mind, and I told my wife a long time ago, if I ever got into a role where I needed to have an advisor, she'd be my advisor because she remembers everybody, everyone's name, all the details, and my brain's not wired that way. And I'm like, I know you, but my wife's like, oh yeah, you met him at a party. We were talking about this. The wife's a veterinarian. He's a doctor. I'm like, how do you remember that?
That's what they do.
Now, I will say this. If he also, with that said, Holly does have a picture, a family picture at her desk that we'll see eventually. And
well, we saw it already. We saw it 2 weeks ago when she placed it down. Well, you did too because you've seen the movie.
Okay, well, I don't know what level of game we're playing with our audience, but I will say, obviously, she's had a picture. And if they've been close executive and CEO kind of relationships where she is in his office and vice versa, he would have at least seen his picture a number of times.
Right.
And if he sent for him or Holly, as I hypothesized yesterday, may have mentioned, you know, maybe we could send a card, make sure he doesn't get lost on his way here. Obviously, the boss here is agreeing. It was the least we could do is send a car for you. He may have been on the lookout, just kind of keeping an eye when John would show up.
Right. He also probably had somewhat of an idea at what time John was supposed to show up. I mean, the plane is supposed to come in at X time, and we ordered the limo to pick him up at Y, and it's a 25-minute drive from LAX to here. You know, so it's around now. I should be seeing this guy who's sort of standing out like a sore thumb. You know,
On the flip side, what would be funny, which we haven't seen, but if any money was changing hands, maybe they were just having an office pool of whether or not he would even show up.
Yeah, that could be awesome. That's true. Because Holly didn't know.
You know. That's the funny thing. We'll get that sense later. But yeah, you're right. I think it shows everyone was maybe hoping he'd show, not knowing whether or not he would, which means he never committed.
Right. Correct. And he didn't call before he got on the plane. So, yeah. Now, I mean, what's funny is that Takagi says it was the least we can do. So is he implying there that, okay, Holly is working like a dog, so, you know, we might as well help her out and, you know, send a limo for her husband?
Yeah, I always took it as he so respected what Holly was doing, and it's a statement. Once again, it sounds like it's idle chit-chat on the surface. It's conveying a message. Holly is a respected and super important member of the team.
Yes, for sure. Maybe it was maybe he's saying it was the least we can do because we wanted her to stay here and continue working. And instead of sending her out to go pick you up at the airport.
She begged to leave the office, but we don't believe in letting that happen.
Exactly. It reminds me of, you know, the whole thing in Google. You know, they claim that the offices of Google, they have everything there so that people won't miss a minute of work. You know, they have doctors on staff, so you can make a doctor's appointment, you know, or get a teeth cleaning or whatever it is, you know. So it saves time because you just go to another office, take care of it, and you're in the same building, you know, that type of thing.
Seems like a benefit, but it's really to make you stay on the work more.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it
But I do down. Think in this case, I take it as a respectful thing, basically conveying. Yeah. And I think Takagi, in his mind, it is a formal compliment to the husband saying it's the least we could do for somebody who we value. I mean, to me, it seems culturally, it sends a nice message.
Right. Okay. I agree with you on that. There's no question about that. And then he starts talking about the fact, you know, that they're still in the middle of construction, which, you know, on the one hand, he's conveying this information to John, but on the other hand, the screenwriter is telling us, you know, that there are floors that are not ready yet, you know. So I like that little twist there, that they're giving us this type of information.
Ironically, when they were filming in the building for the shots, the building wasn't yet complete. There were uncompleted floors still.
Well, that helped. They did that on purpose. Yeah. And then the two of them begin a West Wing-esque walk and talk. You know, the two of them continue walking as, you know, we're going through a hallway as he starts talking. Takagi says, Holly went to the vault room to fax some documents. She should be back any minute. So my first question is, okay, why do you have to go to the vault room to fax documents? Is that the only place where they have faxes?
Well, I think we're gonna now we can get into some, I guess, corporate level conspiracy. You know, the story that I will say first that likens it to where I'm headed with this is, you know, when Spielberg was initially working with Kubrick to develop the script for the movie AI, Kubrick was so worried that someone might stumble on their conversations, he made Spielberg install a dedicated fax line in a closet that he would keep locked. And it was Steven's job to go by that closet from time to time to see if any notes came from Kubrick and vice versa. Nobody could stumble across it. It didn't go through the general fax. So maybe the corporate executives back in Tokyo, there's regular faxes for business work, but you go to the vault for stuff that has to go back to the head office.
Okay, I never thought about that, and that's a great idea. I will give you credit for that one now.
It's a secure bat fax line.
There you go. That's right. So what do you know about fax machines?
I know a good bit because I grew up in an industry that when the fax had become really, really popular, I remember the first few attempts, the companies that tried to do it were so far ahead of the time that they lost a lot of money, but eventually caught on. And now it was one of those things that was so used every day for so many years that it almost in the blink of an eye, when you could start doing attachments and emails, just suddenly disappeared.
Right. Okay. Well, when do you think the first fax machine was created?
I believe, and I don't know like prototype versus when you started having ones that were being put on the market, but I think it was actually even in the 70s.
It was much earlier than that.
Oh, I'm sure the prototype. Earlier.
Right. No, so the first telephone transmission was in 1964, but we'll get there in a second. All right. So first of all, a fax machine is short for facsimile. It's sometimes known as a telecopying machine or a telefax, okay, which is short for a telefacsimile. It's a telephonic transmission of scanned printed material, both either text or images, normally to a telephone number connected to a printer or other output device. Okay, basically it sends a single fixed graphic image, which is converted into a bitmap and is sent over an audio frequency tones, sent over the telephone system by audio frequency tones, right? Then the receiving fax machine takes those tones and reconstructs the image and then is able to print out a paper copy of it. Okay, so originally the most people think of fax machines because they were very popular in the 80s and 90s, but the whole idea that spawned fax machines started in 1846. There was a Scottish inventor named Alexander Bain who was able to reproduce graphic signs in laboratory experiments. And, you know, he actually got a patent in 1843 for his electric printing telegraph. And I mean, we're not going to go into all the various versions of fax machines, but I mean, they continued from the 1840s all the way till here in 1924, scientists at AT&T were able to electronically send 15 photographs via the telephone between Cleveland and New York. I mean, again, there's a lot of stepping stones for the way that things moved over the course of the year.
Okay, yeah, for the innovation. Okay, but I'm sorry, and I was coming at it from a documentary I remember seeing, and I thought it was Xerox that was the company that was trying to make it an office tool. Like they tried to popularize it, not just having it as a cool, innovative thing to do a piece, but the ability to literally put a document in on one end and scan it and send it and reproduce it like a copy on the other end.
Yes, and you are correct. In 1964, the Xerox company, or Xerox Corporation, created the first commercialized version of a modern fax machine, and it was known as an LDX, a long-distance xerography. Xerography? I don't know how that's pronounced. Xerography, probably. Right. It was considered relatively small. How small do you think it was? Let's talk weight wise. How many pounds or kilograms do you think it was? This machine in 1964.
prior to like the, I'm going to guess probably 20 or 30 pounds.
And you would be only halfway there. It was 46 pounds. This was considered a small facsimile machine. 46 pounds or 21 kilograms. Okay. Now it would take, it would take 6 minutes to send one page.
Well, those baud rates weren't quite where they were they are today.
No, no, not at all. So, as you mentioned, email and, you know, all the modern and the World Wide Web and modern technology has pretty much made fax machines almost completely obsolete. But that's not true, because there are countries which electronic signatures are not valid on contracts by law. So you have to still fax these various contracts. So there are companies that still use it. There's, it's mostly used in businesses. In Japan, there it's widely used in Japan. So I guess the Nakatomi corporation is still using it.
And it may be interesting. It may be the laws of those countries because of that. I didn't think about it, because in the U.S., a lot has been done in the last couple of decades for electronic signature or putting to file. This is your acceptance. By clicking this, you acknowledge this is your signature. So you can do a lot of everything from mortgages to loans and things you can do with a click.
Yeah. And they did a study. And in 2018, 2/3 of Canadian doctors were still primarily using fax machines to communicate with other doctors. Okay. Because most of them see that faxes are considered more safer and more secure than most electronic systems that you have around nowadays.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it goes back to your story with Kubrick. Kubrick thought the same thing. So I guess all these Canadian doctors and Kubrick have a conspiracy together as to, you know, whether it's safe to use a fax machine or not. You know, you have the new tagline, just when you thought it was safe to stop sending faxes.
Yeah. It's safe to fax again.
Yes, exactly. So as they're having their little walk and talk, so Takagi says to John, well, in the meantime, her office is right back here. And they walk towards the door of her office, and we get to see the nameplate on the sign, which says H.M. Gennaro, Director, Corporate Affairs. Okay. I don't really know what someone does as the director of corporate affairs. Do you have any idea?
Well, I can only guess based on the title. Because, I mean, when you talk about corporate affairs, talking about the business relations with other businesses. So if you're trying to coordinate other business activity, try to coordinate whatever other schedules, that'd be what I would think. Managing basically the affairs of the corporation.
Right. No, I don't know the answer to that. This was, you know, this was one thing I couldn't figure out. So yeah, I knew you're pretty knowledgeable. So I thought maybe you would know what someone does in this type of position. I mean, we find out later in the movie that she's basically second in command.
Okay. You know, I mean, it's a senior, obviously it's an executive level position, says so.
But it's a senior executive.
Right. I was gonna say it's a senior or upper level exec. It may be that it's changed now. It may be that what we call business affairs is now more like the business director today.
It could be.
Or director of business.
Could be. Now, did you notice the way they spelled Gennaro on her nameplate on the door? Because last week when John needed to push the buttons on the computer system, Gennaro is spelled differently in both those places. So in the computer system, it's spelled G-E-N-N-A-R-O. And here it's G-E-N-N-E-R-O. So I guess Holly herself isn't quite sure, you know, whether she wants it to be an E or an A.
How to spell her maiden name? I think more or less it's the nameplates that they had to get over translated from Japanese to American. Somewhere somebody transposed a vowel.
Right. But I must tell you that according to the script, it's with an E. So therefore, the computer system is where they got it wrong.
The computer's wrong. Well, there you know, those computers are always glitchy.
Completely, especially those computers in 1988. So then the two of them walk into her office. And the first thing that I noticed, and I've never noticed this before, is there's like a little shelf as they enter it, like in the foyer of her office. And there are four different, I guess you could say, dolls or sculptures or something, decorations that are there. I've never noticed them before.
Really?
Okay.
You've never noticed saw the them? Santa Claus? I was always drawn to the Santa because we always had these animated Santas. We had a Santa and an angel when the kids were a lot littler that we put on each side of the fireplace on the hearth, and they were animated, and they would go through these motions, and when they had the little – like they were holding their little candle just like the Santa here, which isn't moving, but we could turn ours off, and it would just sit there. Right. I thought it was interesting that you've got a Tutankhamun, like an Egyptian egg
That's right.
on the shelf.
Because
right. everything else is Christmas except that.
What are the other two? What would you do? You know what they are?
Well, the other one looks like a gingerbread house, or at least a snow covered house.
Mm-hmm. Gingerbread house.
The red and white object to me looked like almost like it was missing the head of a cookie jar or something, like a Santa cookie jar.
I actually think I thought that was like a Scrooge or not Scrooge. What's his name? The Grinch or something like that. It looks somewhat like the Grinch. It's hard to tell. But you could be right that it's also some sort of cookie jar. It's yeah, a little difficult to tell.
Although it's missing its head, but it looks like it could be a Santa. Well, anyways, it's red and white with a little bit of green in front, almost giving you those. Which, again, you've got Christmas. You've got Christmas colors. You got a Christmas snow color type gingerbread house. And then all of a sudden you get a gold.
King Tut.
Doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know who King Tut was?
King Tutankhamun. I mean, I know of the name, but I don't know a lot about his history.
Besides the Batman, villain.
Not that King Tut.
So Tutankhamun.
No, not the music group.
That's right, King Tut. No, that was Steve Martin, King Tut, wasn't it?
Right. That's right. That's right.
There's SNL, I think. Yeah, I think it was an SNL skit. So Tutankhamun was an Egyptian pharaoh who was the last of his royal family to rule during the end of the 18th dynasty, which was somewhere between 1332 and 1323 BC. You know, and his remains were actually discovered in 1922 by a man named Howard Carter. And the tomb was almost entirely intact. And they found more than 5,000 artifacts in this tomb. And the archaeological find actually sparked a renewed interest in ancient Egypt. So people became much more interested because of this, especially because they would see the Tutankhamun mask, right? Mm-hmm. And people would just call him King Tut for short because it was just easier, I guess. So I do have a few things to say about the Grinch, but your knowledge is much better than mine, and that's not the Grinch. So we won't talk about the Grinch. we'll skip the Grinch to that. Then you have a gingerbread house, right? Which is, do you know how to, have you ever made a gingerbread house?
We do that as part of we talked about yesterday, the treasure hunt we do Christmas Day, but Christmas Eve is always considered a sort of a game/activity night. And one of the things we do is a gingerbread house decorating contest that we actually then use Facebook and, I think Facebook specifically, we put all of them online, and through the course of the evening, everyone who responds to the vote of which one they like the best, that's how we judge who wins, and they win a prize.
Oh, wow. That is so cool.
So we have interactive social media with our kids.
Hey, why not? If it works.
But yeah, no, I do enjoy decorating a gingerbread house. It is kind of fun. Brings me back to my preschool and elementary school days of doing a craft with the kids.
Right. Okay, there is something to that. A gingerbread house is a novelty confectionery which is shaped like a building that is made of cookie dough, cut and baked into appropriate components like walls and roofing. The usual material is crisp ginger biscuit made of gingerbread from the ginger nuts. Right? Sometimes people use boiled dough, which can be molded like clay to form edible statuettes or other decorations. I found that to be really cool. I mean, again, me being Jewish, we never did the gingerbread house thing. It sounds very cool what you do. We have our own traditions, not on Christmas, but actually we do have our own traditions on Christmas. We go out to the movies, but you know, that's separate.
Because everything else is closed, right? No, just kidding.
No, pretty much. Pretty much. Now where I live, everything's open on Christmas. That's not a problem.
Everything's open.
You know, in Israel, nothing closes on Christmas. It's the opposite.
You could do gingerbread with your kids. I mean, it's not a religious
thing. No, not at all.
It's more of a winter decoration thing.
Right. Well, we don't have winters here like you do. You know,
that's true.
Things are a little different. All right. And then the fourth and final thing, which again is only the third that we're talking about because there is no Grinch, is Santa Claus. So first of all, do you know other names for Santa Claus?
Oh yeah. Saint Nick, Saint Nicholas, Father Christmas. You've got all the different, almost every country has their version of a Saint Nicholas or a Santa Claus.
Right. And you missed the Kris Kringle. You know, that's the one.
Kris Kringle, yeah, sure.
There you go. Do you know where the idea of Santa Claus came from?
Well, St. Nicholas was the guy in the early Catholic Church who would go and try to provide food or treats to kids in need by putting stuff into their stockings if they put them out. And so that's where sort of the tradition started.
Right. Okay. And it was mostly known. Do you know how it came to America?
But depending what you're asking, I don't know how it came specifically. I know how our version of Santa came
right.
to be.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. Your version of Santa.
Our version. I didn't know this until a little while ago, but it was actually a marketing campaign for Coca-Cola. The guy that who was tasked in New York, I think it was New York, but whatever ad agency that was tasked with this marketing campaign decided after couldn't find a model, decided to just use his own likeness to create now what is considered the American version of Santa Claus.
Okay, very cool. That's not where I was going, but that's also very interesting. So,
okay. I thought that's what you wanted.
No, you're right. That's fine. That's perfect. Where I was going was where the name Santa Claus actually was first used in the U.S. press, which was in 1773. Because it was known beforehand as Sinterklaas from the Dutch settlers would refer to that. And they usually had him dressed as a Dutch sailor with a pipe in a green winter coat. And in 1809, Washington Irving put out a book called History of New York, and he created a parody of Dutch culture in New York. Sort of as like a Saturday Night Live type of thing, right? And his interpretation of Santa Claus was done in order to try to tone down the wild Christmas celebration of the era. Because apparently, what would people do on Christmas back in those days? There was aggressive home invasions, okay? There was substantial premarital sex leading to many shotgun weddings, especially in areas where Puritans were living.
I am this many years old, first time hearing that.
And you're like, damn, I should have known that when I was 18.
Holy crap, I've been spending a lot of Christmas, honey. We got to get caught up on Christmas Eve. You know, here I am building bikes and assembling toys. I should have been having a little fun.
Exactly. The Puritans were very much opposed to Christmas. So that's why there were many problems of these shotgun weddings. And there was also much public display of sexual deviancy. Okay.
Once again, honey, I missed out on Christmas.
Yeah. In 1823, there was a poem that came out called A Visit from St. Nicholas, where caricaturist and political cartoonist Thomas Nast was able to create the idea of Santa's image, right? Now, the image was a white-bearded man, often with glasses, wearing a red coat with white fur collars and cuffs, white fur-cuffed red trousers, red hat with white fur, and a black leather belt and boots, and he would be carrying a bag full of gifts for children. He's usually portrayed as being laughing or jolly, and saying the famous words that we're going to get to later in this movie, ho, 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 I now have a machine gun.
Now, I have a machine gun too.
No, I don't think he says two. I think it's now I have a machine gun, but whatever. I don't know. We'll get there. We'll get there. So they continue walking into the room, and we hear someone at Holly's desk, and we look up and we see Harris Ellis, who we met earlier. And you can obviously see that he is sniffing cocaine off of Holly's desk. And he
wait, doesn't he have his own desk? I mean, why? Although this is actually a nice little contextual clue when you look back of him trying to make a move on Holly. Maybe he thought he'd catch her in there. Maybe he thought he could convince her. She's not there, so he figured, well, while I'm waiting for her, maybe he thought she's going to be coming back from the vault. I'll have her all to myself. Let me just get myself amped up with just a little line of coke for the evening.
Exactly. That's very good. And I like the fact that you know, coke is basically Ellis, because later on when he's, you know, trying to make his business deal, they bring him a glass of coke. You know, they purposely
Which is after he sneaks a little spoonful of coke to get ready for that meeting.
Yes, completely. So he's mixing coke with coke. You know.
Yeah, that's always been like the bad dad joke where you go, hey, I tried sniffing coke once. I just couldn't get the can up my nose.
Right. Exactly. So he quickly gets up. You hear him sniffing and he goes, I was just making a call and this was the nearest phone.
Right. Oh, it's such a blatant lie. And once again, little touches of set dressing when he's rapidly putting his little spoon and little box or bottle away into his pocket. There's a little bit of white left on the desk.
Yeah.
Just enough to be perceptible that he manages to go, well, I better wipe that as I stand up. Look at all in one motion, like almost as if he's done it before.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't want to get caught on these types of things. So what do you know about cocaine?
Ironically, Coca-Cola had some of it initially when the formula came out.
That's sort of where it came. That's where the coca came from in the thing. But we're not talking about Coca-Cola. I'll wait a few months till we talk about Coca-Cola when we'll get there. You know, we'll talk about this, the other type of coke at this point. So what do you know about?
Wasn't cocaine developed? Now I'm stretching back to my early psychopharmacology days in my degree, which I have never put to use after spending all that money for it.
Well, you wasn't see, now you have an opportunity to put it to use.
To help get you off of an addiction to heroin or morphine?
I do remember hearing that, yes.
Yeah, I think – and it was – I think initially people didn't think it was addictive. They thought it was okay because I believe it was Freud, the psychologist Freud said, you know, when they realized cocaine was addictive later, he said, I was able to stop cocaine once I realized that I it wasn't good for you, but I never could stop smoking cigars.
Exactly. So basically cocaine is a tropane, alkaloid, and stimulant drug obtained primarily from the leaves of two different coca species that are native to South America. Cocaine is actually one of the drugs that's able to cross the blood-brain barrier because it has a proton-coupled organic cation antiporter, because, you know, most of the time things don't go into your brain. You know, the body has a system that keeps toxins from getting up into the brain. You know, you can't pass this blood-brain barrier, and there are very few things that can get through it. But unfortunately, cocaine is one of them that can. And
well, I go back to the old Bill Cosby routine. If you remember the comedy routine called Bill Cosby himself.
Yes.
He said cocaine is good because it enhances your personality. And he says, great. But what if you're an asshole?
That is very true. So cocaine is very addictive due to its effect on the reward pathway in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
like most stimulant narcotics, it develops, you feel really good and really positive. Yes. It does give you a sense of like, oh, I'm on top of the world. Of course, my heart's racing at about 200 beats per minute. But hey, I feel great.
Right. So most people get addicted to it because dependency is very likely once you take it numerous times, because there's very difficult drug withdrawal. But some of the symptoms of or the effects of withdrawal could be depression, decreased libido, decreased ability to feel pleasure, and subjective fatigue. So I guess you have to do this on the Christmases from the 1700s. That would make things a little easier. Yeah, when you're trying to on a cocaine withdrawal, right? In 2018, how many people in the world do you think still use cocaine or are addicted to cocaine? I mean, I don't know. How do you want to
differentiate? No.
Okay. So 19 million people were using cocaine in 2018. 0.4% of all people in the world aged 18 to 64. The highest number of people who were using cocaine at the time were living in Australia or New Zealand, and followed very closely by people in North America. So, yeah, it's slightly a problem. I'm assuming that the numbers in 2022 are not that different. You know, they're relatively close.
I had heard, and I don't know if this is right, because I know cocaine went away or dropped because of its cost in favor of crack cocaine, which I think they consider separate.
We'll get there in a second.
Because I thought I heard cocaine usage kind of was making a sort of chic comeback. Or is that heroin? I think it's heroin, I'm thinking.
I don't know. I don't know enough about drugs.
I will tell you, I'm honest, I am not steeped in drug culture.
Neither am I.
I've never been fascinated by it. I've never been tempted, especially any Ditto. Hard drugs. I'm Ditto. Fine with a cocktail. I've always enjoyed a beer, a wine, liquor of all flavors and sorts. I'm usually pretty good.
Right. Okay. So there are three different ways that people take in cocaine. One of the ones is obviously what we just saw with Ellis, which is known as nasal insufflation, okay, which is mostly known as either snorting, sniffing, or blowing. Okay. It's absorbed through the nose and the lining of the nasal passages. And usually when people snort cocaine, it takes about 5 minutes for it to kick in. But okay. The reason most people use this type of form of snorting cocaine is that it has the longest duration of its effects, which usually can last anywhere between an hour and an hour and a half.
Oh, okay? It doesn't last as long as I thought it does. That's okay.
Again, this is information from Wikipedia. So, you know, I'm not talking from experience.
Same with me. Let's say, you know, guess I decide a night of debauchery is in order, you know, go back and celebrate the old fashioned Christmas.
Yes, exactly. Then the second method is injection. There are people who actually inject cocaine, which I'd never even heard of. I always thought that's just heroin that people inject. And the biggest side effect of injecting yourself with cocaine is that most people have tinnitus or audio distortion for 2 to 5 minutes after injecting them with this, so it's colloquially known as a bell ringer.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then the third way of doing this is for people to actually smoke it, which is what became known as crack cocaine. Crack cocaine is actually smoking. The reason that most people prefer to smoke their cocaine is that it takes anywhere between 3 to 5 seconds for it to actually start affecting you.
But I also thought crack cocaine was much cheaper. You can cut it down and make it a lot smaller, so it's not as expensive as cocaine itself.
Okay, it could be. Yeah, for sure. But again, part of the whole idea is that
it's even more addictive. Because of the process of chemically manufacturing it, that it's being a non-natural substance, being a more chemically made substance, instantly creates an addiction. Some people can be hooked even after one use.
Right. But what they also say is that this, when you smoke it, the effects usually only last between 2 and 10 minutes, which I guess also makes it more addictive because you constantly want to, you know, get this feeling back.
Keep hitting the crack pipe.
Apparently. So yeah, that's all we got for crack today. we're done with crack today. And at this point, Takagi pretty much ignores what Ellis has been doing and says to
Well,
He says to Ellis, he goes, well, I want you to meet John McClane, Holly's husband. And then he says in a different tone of his voice, Holly's policeman. Now, I got to tell you, every time I've seen this movie, I always thought he says Holly's policeman husband. This is the first time I noticed that he doesn't say the word husband again. Yeah, he goes, just says Holly's policeman. Mm. He introduces Ellis and says, Ellis is in charge of international development. And the entire time, Ellis is sniffing. You keep hearing him sniff. And then he says, heard a heck of a lot about you. And then John looks at him and goes, miss him.
That, I love that it shows once again, as smooth and as slick as Ellis thinks he was, the cop didn't miss a second, knows exactly what he was doing.
Well, especially when you have a black beard. You're snorting white also, things with a black beard.
Yeah, I don't know if you see anything on Ellis, though, do you?
I didn't, but I'm not an astute policeman as
but that's
John
what
is.
I love about that's what I love about McClane, because it lets us know, and he's not afraid to let the person know, by the way. Not just that he observed it. He's willing to say, miss some. Like, I know what you did.
I think you can see there's a little white on his nose, on the side of his nose.
Okay.
I think so. I could be wrong. It's very hard to pause it as it moves along.
The fact that he shares that knowledge and just completely walks past it. Yeah. Going back to Takagi, though, when you said, he said Hollis is a policeman. Holly's policeman. When I hear it, you're right. I've always heard either filled in Holly's husband's a policeman. Like I hear husband in my head.
Yes.
Or like Hollis, he's a policeman. Like he was trying to say Ellis and then said Holly instead of Ellis. Ellis is a policeman. Like, hey, he's a policeman. He's just sort of adding a "z," you know, kind of slurring the word together. But that's interesting. I wonder if that's just because the actor missed the word.
No, there is no word. Well, we'll get to the script in a little while, how they talk about that. But it's just amazing, as you know, we mentioned yesterday, how many times each of us has seen this movie, and we've just always automatically, you know, auto-corrected Takagi.
Right.
Without even noticing it until this point. Now, almost 20 years ago, I was actually a policeman. I was a policeman for a few months here in Israel. I hated it, and, you know, it was a dream of mine. And, you know, I quit my job and went and joined the police force. And, you know, I really had such high hopes for it. And I was just pretty much disillusioned pretty quickly and got out of it. And, you know, I've never regretted it. I actually, you know, I'm glad that I did it. It's the idea that you can try something that you always want to do. And if it doesn't work out, you can still move on with your life. I'll never have the idea in my mind saying, oh, I wish I could try it. You know, if only I would have, you know, followed my dream at that point. I followed my dream, didn't go where I wanted to be, went back to my other thing, and here I am doing a podcast. You know, that's my latest dream, you know, and I'm on my third season of a podcast too. But the point I wanted to make about the fact of being a policeman is I remember in the police academy, one of the things they taught us was that a policeman has more power than a judge. Okay, and the reason for that is if someone comes to court, the judge has to use the law in order to make his judgment as to whether the person is guilty or whether the person is innocent. A policeman, on the other hand, can see something happen and decide not to do anything about it. A policeman can pull someone over for speeding and not give them a ticket. If you come to court, you know, and the judge finds you guilty, then he's going to give you a fine. You know, the judge cannot say, oh, well, you're guilty, but I'm going to not give you a fine. He has to give you some sort of punishment. A policeman doesn't need to give you that punishment. He has the ability to, you know, make the decision of letting you go scot-free, letting you off with a warning or whatever it is. So I've always seen what John does here in that light, where he's saying, okay, you know, I've seen it, but I'm not doing anything about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, when we add to it, it's not his jurisdiction. He's probably not on duty. I mean, what's he going to do? But that's why I love the fact that he calls it out anyway.
Right. Exactly. That's his personality. You know, he's calling it out for sure. And then,
and you know what I love about it is it by calling it out, not only does it give us an insight, a continued insight very quickly into the personality of John McClane, we also get a sense of Ellis. He's so used to getting away with everything. Then it makes you wonder, does he just fool himself all the time? Does everybody know he's full of most of the time, but they never call him on it? It's John McClane who calls him on
it. Right. Well, I think it's the same thing with what we saw 2 weeks ago when he was hitting on Holly. You know, Holly wasn't calling him on it. She was pushing him away and saying this isn't going to happen. But, you know, what he was doing is definitely sexual harassment. I mean, she could have easily gotten him fired. I mean, I don't know what the laws were in 1988 in L.A. at the time. But, you know, she definitely could have complained. Mm-hmm. For, I mean, the way that he was acting is, you know, today he'd be a Hollywood producer.
Hey, we're casting a movie. Come on up to my hotel.
There you go. So Takagi then tries to quickly change the conversation. And he goes, well, could I get you anything? Food, cake, some watered down champagne. And John's response is, no, thank you. I'm fine. And then John says, you throw quite. And then the minute actually ends. So we're going to have to wait until tomorrow to find out what he throws quite. You know, does he throw a football quite well? Does he? What is he throwing? Who knows?
So I want to ask you to do something quickly here before we wrap up the minute, because I don't know if you noticed in terms of imagery. We saw the Santa Claus. We saw the gingerbread house. We even got some Egyptian mythology. The shot right around 42 seconds when Ellis is walking up and Takagi's kind of leaning in, getting ready to leave a word out of his sentence that we all mentally fill in.
Okay.
You notice that on the wall,
it's a cross.
Directly between Takagi and John McClane, we have a shadow of a cross.
Yes. But you can see the beam. It's the window pane. It's a shadow of the window pane.
But
wow.
It cannot be not observed in the presence of both Santa, and then you've got on the other side, you've got a Japanese official that we're going to have a comment made later about the holiday of Christmas itself.
That's true.
And yet there is at least an imagery of the religious aspect of Christmas to go along with the commercial.
Wow. That's great. I wouldn't have noticed that. That's not the type of thing I look for. But yeah, it's definitely there. You're right. Great pickup on that.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
And you're testing my trivia brain and for looking for imagery on screen.
Okay, why not? That's what we're here for. And so towards the end of this minute, what I like also is that John, you know, when he passes Ellis, he goes over to Holly's desk and he actually picks up one of the pictures on her desk of their son and is looking at John Jr., you know, which it's nice. It shows, you know, that maybe he's looking and saying, wow, my son has grown up a lot in 6 months since I haven't seen him. Or, you know, or, ooh, I'm going to see my son in a little while. You know, it could be many different things. But he doesn't notice the fact that his picture is face down.
No, not yet. No. And what's
he
amazing
never notices
here,
it.
Right. He doesn't ever. Right. What I like about what John McClane, or the actor in this case, Bruce Willis's choices, it's like he's still investigating. He can't let the detective part. He's got a natural curiosity. He's going to look at things. He's going to pick things up. He's going to observe. It's like he can't turn the, hey, let's put this into the back of our minds for the rest of the movie. He can't turn off being a cop.
Right. That's true. That's very true. So the script has a few little discrepancies here. They explain things a little more. So first of all, there's an extended conversation at the beginning of this minute between John and Takagi. So because McClane comes up to him and says, excuse me, I'm looking for her. And he goes, Holly Gennaro. And then McClane actually says, yeah, how'd you know? So Takagi's response is, I've spent half my life on airplanes. I can recognize someone who just got off one. I'm Joe Takagi, Mr. McClane. I have something to do with this company. Okay. Now, first of all, I like the fact that he calls him Mr. McClane as opposed to John McClane. He's much more formal. You know, it goes back to the idea of Japanese businessman, you know, being more formal and stuff like that. And then, you know, he sort of makes a joke by saying, well, I have something to do with this company. You know, I'm the CEO or whatever. I don't remember what Takagi, maybe he's the CFO. But, you know, he's very high up in it. And so McClane goes, so I've heard. And then Takagi smiles, leads the way as they approach Holly's office. McClane notices the name on the door is Gennaro. And then Takagi mentions that she went to the vault room, and then they enter the room and they see Ellis sniffling and snorting. And, you know, he gives his quick lie as to that he was just making a quick call. And then Takagi goes, Ellis, this is John McClane, Holly's policeman. Ellis is in charge of international acquisitions. See, they changed it from acquisitions to development. And then McClane shakes hands with Ellis and looks up at him and says, that explains the recent deal with Bolivia. And that's
yeah, I think that joke would have gone over most people's
exactly. heads. Exactly. I had to read it three times in the script to try and catch that that's what they're saying with, you know, McClane saying you missed the spot. So it,
right.
Yeah. So it says Ellis much, reacts.
Much better to say it the way Bruce Willis
did. Yeah, for sure. No question about that. It says Ellis reacts, runs a checking finger under his nose. And then McClane turns to him and says, relax, Ellis. I'm off duty. But I like the way that it's in the final script much better. No question about that.
Plays much better on screen.
Yeah. Yeah. The novel doesn't have any of this in there, so there's nothing really to go there. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Hans Hump Day, where
all right.
where my guests will give their top five performances by Alan Rickman. So what have you got
okay. for us? All right. Now, you just said performances, but I thought the note you sent me said top five Alan Rickman movies. And to me, that's different. I picked movies I love where Alan Rickman is in it versus maybe movies where Alan Rickman was wonderful, but the movie wasn't so great. So I went with movies. Is that okay?
It's fine. I mean, if you want to quickly change that, you can too.
No, because I mean,
it depends on which one you prefer.
I'll explain with my number three, but I will do a reverse countdown. My number five, this is a guilty pleasure movie. My wife and I both love it. We both saw it in the theaters before we ever met one another, and it's one of our go-to movies, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah. A spoon.
You cannot beat his Sheriff of Nottingham. You cannot beat it. Even if it's anachronistic with some of the use of language and phrases, the screen just comes alive every time Alan Rickman is
there. Yes, for sure.
Number four, Galaxy Quest. I'm a Star Trek fan at heart, and to me, Galaxy Quest was always meant to be a love letter to Star Trek fans, and I still love that movie to this day.
Yes.
Number three, and this is where I was getting at performance versus movie. But my number three favorite movie that has Alan Rickman in it would be Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. To me, the third Harry Potter movie is still probably the best story of all of them, which is why it's my favorite movie. If I had to say acting, if I had picked the Harry Potter universe, because let's face it, Professor Snape is a huge part of it.
Yes.
It's hard to argue between The Half-Blood Prince, number six, which is really about Snape's, or the Deathly Hallows Part 2, where we learn exactly what Snape has been up to this entire series.
For sure.
It's phenomenal acting. But in terms of movie, I still think Prisoner of Azkaban is a better film.
Yes.
Number two, one of my other all-time favorite Christmas movies. We watch it at least once a year and at the holidays. The English schmaltzy rom-com Love Actually. Other Hollywood has tried to mirror or replicate the formula that was done in Love Actually, and they all suck. The only one I like that follows that kind of everyone has a story, but they all somehow are intermingled is Love Actually, and I cannot get enough of that movie. We'll probably watch it at least two other times in the year, and then definitely every single holiday. That's one of the Christmas movies we go to.
Right.
And then number one, without a doubt, should be of no surprise if you're listening to this podcast, my all-time favorite Christmas film,
Die Hard. Not Christmas film. It's your all-time favorite Alan Rickman film.
It is my favorite Christmas movie. And okay. We watch Die Hard multiple times a year, but it has been a tradition even with my kids. Last year was the first year that there was not a single kid here that when I watched the movie, so I ended up watching it by myself, but almost always, at some point, one or more of my girls would watch the movie with me leading up to either Christmas Eve or leading up to Christmas Eve.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. All right. Great.
There's my list.
There you go. Thank you very much for that. Do you want to tell everyone how they can get in touch with you, Alan.
Sure, we'll make it quick. You can just do a search for The Wilder Ride. That's both podcast, website, social media. Everything's the same. It's about Gene Wilder, at least our first two seasons. We did become a Wilder podcast in the sense of being wild by changing it up a couple of times. We turned it into more of a talk show format for a couple of years and have been on an extended hiatus this season. But my co-host, Walt Murray, says we are going to bring it back once he gets back from his four-month-long or now five-month-long honeymoon. Well, eventually his wife will get tired of his shenanigans and allow him to start recording again.
I think maybe you should tell him about how they used to celebrate Christmas.
He's doing that now. He's doing that every day. I'm going to tell my wife how
they celebrate. Exactly. All right. And finding me is very simple. You just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.